Margaret Stock is an immigration attorney, a retired Army officer, and she's an independent candidate for U.S. Senate. She says she's running as an independent because gridlock between the two major parties has made Congress ineffective. What will she work to do to change that stalemate if she's elected to the Senate? We'll find out her ideas on compromise, national defense, Alaska's economy, and a host of other issues today when candidate Margaret Stock is our guest on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Margaret Stock is in Kodiak today in preparation for tomorrow's fisheries debate, and she's joining us by phone from our great partners KMXT in Kodiak. Hello and welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ms. Stock.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
If you have questions for Margaret Stock, you can join our conversation today. You can call 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So before I launch into some questions, please tell us about, give us some information about your background and why you think you should be Alaska's next U.S. Senator.
Well, I'm a 30-year Alaskan. I also spent 28 years in the U.S. Army Reserve Military Police Corps, starting when I was commissioned in 1982 and ending in June 2010 when I was transferred to the retired reserve, and I'm still in the retired reserve of the Army Reserve. I'm also an Alaska attorney. I took the bar exam, passed it first time in 1993, and I've been an attorney in Alaska since then. I started my early career working on a variety of different cases, including cases involving timber in southeast Alaska, oil and gas issues. I've represented folks in the fishing community as well, and folks all over Alaska. So I've had two careers, an attorney in Alaska and also an Army Reserve officer. And I spent about 9 years working on issues in Washington, D.C. related to immigration and national security. Although I was living in Alaska officially, my family was in Alaska. I was flying back and forth a lot. And I was also teaching at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York, for a period from about 2001 until I reached my statutory retirement date in 2010 with the military. And during that time, I was not representing private clients. I was mainly working on issues for the United States government, testifying in front of Congress, drafting legislation, working with offices on Capitol Hill, working at the Pentagon and the administrative agencies. I worked a lot with the Department of Homeland Security, as well as the Department of Defense and the Department of State and the Department of Labor occasionally.
All right. Well, thanks for that bio. If you're just joining us, Margaret Stock, independent candidate for U.S. Senate, is our guest on Talk of Alaska today. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email questions, talk@alaskapublic.org. Ms. Stock, you were a Republican for a lot of years, most of your adult life. Why did you decide to defect and be an independent?
Well, as many people have said, the party left me. The party became more and more extreme and started rejecting the values that I held. I'm an individual who believes in individual rights and personal freedom, and the party seemed to be heading in a direction where they were against individual rights and personal freedom. And they also, the party became more extreme on a number of issues that I'm expert on, including immigration and the 14th Amendment that says people who are born in the United States are American citizens. National Party leaders were saying that should no longer be the law, and they were questioning the citizenship of the President of the United States, and I found that troubling.
The Democrats offered you a spot on their ticket, which would have meant state party assistance. Was it tough to turn down the offer of organizational help?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I'm an independent. I'm not a Democrat, and the Democrats did not. I'm not sure what you mean. I am part of the coordinated campaign of the Democratic Party, and that's because obviously I can't get support from the Republican Party since I'm running against an incumbent Republican. So I reached out to the Democrats, and they made an agreement that I could participate in their coordinated campaign, and I could also use their database resources. So I do have access to those. I have to pay for that, but I've raised enough money to pay the Democratic Party to get access to their voter database, so I am using that.
So clarify that for us. You're getting some assistance from the Democratic Party, but you've carved out a spot as an independent.
Well, I clearly am an independent. I'm not registered as a Democrat. I did not run in the Democratic primary. The Democratic Party was interested in having me run in their primary, but I didn't want to change and become a Democrat, and so they filed a lawsuit against the state of Alaska. The listeners may not realize this, but Alaska has a law that prohibits independents from running in a party primary. And I think that law is unconstitutional. I think it violates the First Amendment, but it is what it is. The Democratic Party had filed a lawsuit to allow independents like me to run in their primary. Unfortunately, they did not get their lawsuit through the courts in time, and there was a deadline for me to announce I was running in their primary, and I couldn't run as an independent in the primary because it would violate the state law. So I ran. I got on the ballot by signatures. That was the alternative, since I was prohibited from running in their primary.
Your campaign material says Congress is failing Alaska. What do you mean by that?
Well, Congress isn't doing what it's supposed to do, and the Senate in particular is now corrupt and broken, and a lot of it is because of partisan warfare that's going on in Washington. And I'll just mention a few things. The Senate isn't holding hearings to fill vacancies on the Supreme Court and in the federal courts and even in other federal agencies. They simply refuse to hold hearings. They have not voted to authorize the use of force, so we have a war going on, and Congress has the constitutional responsibility to authorize the use of force, and they refuse to do that. So we're fighting a war right now. Our troops are fighting, and we have no authorization from Congress because Congress won't do its job. They won't pass a budget. There are basic responsibilities that the legislative branch has right now, and they're simply not fulfilling them. And it's terrible for the structure of our government because we're supposed to have three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And the legislative branch is essentially broken right now. And because the legislative branch is broken, the judicial branch is not fully functioning. So we have two dysfunctional branches in the three branches of government. And, of course, the executive is being called on to solve everybody's problems because the Senate won't do its job, and Congress won't do its job. And the judiciary can't because the Senate won't fill the vacancies, won't hold hearings. And so the president is trying to reach out and solve people's problems, and every time the executive tries to solve problems, people howl and say, executive overreach! But the irony of the whole thing is that the reason there's executive overreach is because the legislative branch will not do its job.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. Margaret Stock, independent candidate for U.S. Senate, is our guest. She's on the phone from Kodiak, where she's preparing for a fisheries debate tomorrow. You can join our conversation if you have questions for the candidate. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the number to call statewide. Or if you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, if you have questions for U.S. Senate candidate Margaret Stock. In one of your campaign ads, you're shown with a chainsaw cutting through a tug-of-war rope between Dems and Republicans. You've just been talking about a lot of the gridlock that is in the legislative body in Congress. Why do you think an independent candidate can get Republicans and Democrats to agree?
Well, because the Senate is a small body, and the parties the balance is very, very tight there in the Senate. And so a single independent or a couple of independents are actually the power brokers if they get elected, because either party will need their assistance to get business done. And the parties right now, if you're a partisan senator, you're captive to the special interests at the moment, because it's all about money. The terrible Citizens United decision by the United States Supreme Court has unleashed this flood of dark money into American politics. And if you watch what partisan senators do every day, it's mostly raising money. They spend all day calling corporations and asking for money, and that's why the spending has gone out of control in Washington on elections. And it's caused their allegiances no longer be to the people of the state who elected them, but rather to the corporations that are giving them money. And that's one of the reasons I'm running as an independent. I don't have to be captive to a national party that will order me to raise money if I want to hold my committee chair. You know, they do that in the House of Representatives. There was a USA Today story about how House members are basically buying their committee chairs now. They have to raise a certain amount of money for the party in order to be a chair of a committee. I think that's terrible. I think it's corrupt. And if you're a member of a party running as a senator now, you're forced to deal with that system, because otherwise, you know, the party bosses tell you what your positions have to be on things, and you don't represent the people of your state anymore. You represent your national party and the corporations that are giving you all that money.
So how, though, does an independent candidate break through? It's not just money that we're talking about. We're talking about congressional members that have to try to get work done across party lines. How can an independent help further that?
Well, an independent can take the best ideas from whatever party they originate and advocate for them. An independent is not bound by clinging to the party line on a particular issue. So it makes you much more powerful, because you can speak the truth to the power in Washington.
Do you think that you would have to caucus with one side or the other?
Well, I don't know. I can't promise ahead of time to caucus with a particular party, because I'm an independent, so I'm not beholden to a party. I have been endorsed by the Centrist Project, and the Centrist Project is a national project to try to get more independents into the Senate to try to break the gridlock. They have political scientists behind their theory that if they can get 3 to 5 independent senators into the U.S. Senate, those senators can form their own independent caucus, and it'll be the most powerful caucus in the United States Senate.
What are you hearing from Alaskans when you're campaigning? What are their biggest concerns?
Well, I'm hearing they don't feel they're represented in Washington very well by their current senators. And, of course, I'm running against Murkowski, but they don't feel that she has really represented them in Washington. They say she talks a good game but doesn't deliver, that mainly they see inaction, or they see flip-flopping on issues of great interest to Alaska. The Supreme Court situation is an example I hear over and over and over again from Alaskans. They're very disappointed. Murkowski wrote in the Juneau Empire in an article more than 10 years ago that if there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, it's the duty of the president, and it's a matter of good governance for the president to nominate somebody, and it's the duty of the Senate to hold hearings on the president's nominee. They don't have to approve the nominee, but they do have to give the nominee a hearing and an up or down vote on the nomination. And that was Murkowski's position in writing more than 10 years ago, and she stuck to that position, and she stuck to it after Antonin Scalia passed away until 2 days later, when she suddenly reversed herself, apparently at the behest of her national party leaders, and proved that she would not stick to principles. She was simply a tool of the National Republican Party, and they had told her not to hold a hearing on the president's nominee, and so she now refuses to hold a hearing on the president's nominee. And that's just one example, but Alaskans tell me that they just don't believe Murkowski can represent them anymore, and a lot of it is because she is beholden to the National Republican Party rather than to ordinary Alaskans.
If you're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is Margaret Stock. She's an independent candidate for U.S. Senate. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Margaret Stock is on the line from Kodiak, so she's not in the studio with me. She's in the studio of KMXT in Kodiak, preparing for tomorrow's fisheries debate. We're going to go to the phones. Mark is in Bethel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Margaret. One of the biggest areas of growth in the federal government has, and one of the quieter ones, has been the growth of the national security state, the privatization of the intelligence community, the privatization of large segments of the military. I read somewhere recently that at the height of our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, there were 8 civilian contractors for every American military personnel in country. The growth of the national security state has been going on since 9/11. Has had impacts on our rights, particularly our privacy rights. Just recently emerged that Yahoo was running a program at the behest of the federal government, doing word searches in Yahoo emails. You've got a long, you retired from the military. Talk a little bit, if you would, please, about what you see as either the dangers or the advantages of what we're seeing in terms of just this exponential growth in the national security industry in this country, and whether you think it's making us any safer, whether you think the size of the Department of Homeland Security is really making us safer. You know, Don Young said that the worst vote he ever took was voting for the original USA Patriot Act. The FBI continues to seek additional national security letter authority. Actually, Senator Murkowski voted the right way in a cloture vote recently on that. Dan Sullivan didn't. Senator Sullivan, to me, seems pretty gray as far as his relationship to to national security. But what are your thoughts about this universal surveillance and the things that we seem to be trending into? So thank you very much, and I'll be listening.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, I'm glad you raised that issue because it's an issue I've studied extensively over the years. As mentioned in my bio, I taught at the United States Military Academy at West Point, New York, and I was a director of the National Security Law course there. And we always hear out there in the news media that we are supposed to make a trade-off between liberty and security, and I don't believe that to be the case. I think part of our security is our Constitution and the principles of liberty that are in the Constitution. I remember a famous picture that appeared shortly after 9/11 of a young child sleeping in her bed, and she was wrapped up in the U.S. Constitution, and the caption of the picture was, "Security Blanket." And I believe that's true. The U.S. Constitution is, in fact, if properly interpreted, a security blanket for Americans. We don't want to give up our liberty in the name of security. We have seen an exponential growth in the rise of the national security state over the last 15 years or so, and it is troubling, particularly when a lot of the security is placed in the hands of private corporations. Corporations, as you know, have the primary motivation of bringing profit to their shareholders, not necessarily a public interest behind them. And so it's really important, and folks in the national security community know this, that we always balance the liberty interests against the need for more and more information about folks. There have to be checks and balances in place to stop the abuse of information that's collected on Americans. And we need to be eternally vigilant to make sure that we don't trade off our liberty for so-called security, because we won't get either one if we do that.
All right. Thank you for that question from Bethel. We're going to stick with the phones for a moment here. Don is in Anchorage. Hi, Don.
Hello, Margaret. You are a welcome and refreshing sight to behold, I'll tell you. I'm a vet. 2 of my daughters are a vet. My dad's a vet. And I had some cousins that were vets. And I also have some people that tend to forget what the Constitution says about what the law of the land is. That's Article 6.
Do you have a question, Don?
I sure do. I'd like to hear more about her stance on the immigration, because she alluded to it a little while ago, and that perked my ears up right away, because not many people care to acknowledge that the Constitution is what sets the basis for immigration and defines who is and is not a citizen. So I'm delighted to hear from you. and I'll get off and let you go at it for a while.
Okay, well, I'm more than happy to talk about immigration. I was awarded a grant by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation in 2013 for my work relating to immigration and national security. And that work grew out of the fact that I was at West Point teaching in my classroom on 9/11 when the terrorists attacked. And in the following 9 or so years after that, I worked almost exclusively on issues relating to immigration and national security for the U.S. government. And, of course, one of the things we were constantly fighting against was a concept that we needed to close our borders, we needed to shut down our borders, we needed to stop any immigrants from coming into the country. And we kept trying to remind people that immigrants were the strength of America, that America became a superpower because it was an immigration nation. And you can go back and look at the Declaration of Independence, and in there you'll see that one of the grievances the colonists had against King George was that he was limiting immigration. And that was because the colonists felt that immigrants brought a tremendous amount of vitality to America. Now, that said, we do have to protect our borders, and we do have to keep the bad guys out, the bad people out of America, those who would want to attack us. But we have to recognize the tremendous contributions that immigrants can make to our national security. And I worked on a program that recruited legal immigrants for the United States military in a time when we were drastically short of people who spoke foreign languages. I was given a medal by the commander of Special Operations Command for figuring out a way to get large numbers of legal, highly cleared non-citizens who spoke foreign languages to go to work for Special Operations Command. It was a highly successful program, and I think it illustrates that you can screen people very, very carefully, but accept the best and the brightest, most talented individuals who will want to become citizens and want to adopt the principles of the United States of America, and will then want to go to work for this great nation that we all call home. And I'm really proud of my work recruiting highly skilled immigrants for the U.S. Armed Forces. Most of the folks you won't see publicly, but there was one individual who just won a silver medal for the United States in Rio at the Olympics, and he was one of the individuals I recruited through my military recruiting program. He joined the Army, signed up for an 8-year tour of duty, and in exchange for joining the Army and signing up for 8 years, he was given American citizenship. Of course, he could lose it if he doesn't serve honorably. But because he became an American citizen, he was able to qualify for the U.S. Olympic team, and he went to Rio along with a number of other folks from the same program. And Paul Chelimo won a silver medal for the United States in Rio because he was a U.S. citizen. He's still in the Army, of course. He ran in Rio as an Olympic athlete while being in the Army, so he's an Army soldier running in the Olympics. And he placed in an event that the U.S. has not placed in for decades, the 5,000-meter men's race, and he came in number 2 with a silver medal for America. Very pleased and proud about that.
Let me get a question in there related to this issue of immigration, because as you're well aware, it's an issue that's drawing a lot of heat in the nation. We have an email question here, someone wanting you to talk about the southern border and refugee immigration from overseas. What would you say to people who are afraid of immigrants from war-torn nations in the Middle East, and to the folks who support the idea of hitting pause with letting virtually anyone into the country until there's a revamping of the criteria that allows people to come in, the vetting process? Do you think that there is work to be done in that regard, and how should it be handled?
Well, I think the public doesn't realize that since 9/11, the U.S. government has been concentrating heavily on screening people who come into the United States. So there's a very robust screening process. A lot of the misinformation was put out because people put videos up of other countries and what's happening in other countries, and they don't show what's happening in the United States. But we've had a tremendous increase in, as somebody caller earlier mentioned, the national security state, and that has included the Department of Homeland Security. There's a tremendous number of resources, billions and billions of dollars being spent right now on screening immigrants. And the refugee population, interestingly, gets the most screening of any group of immigrants, and it's all done overseas before they get to the United States. So I would like to reassure people that the pictures they've seen of refugees overrunning borders in Morocco and so forth are not representative of what's happening here in the United States. We don't have large numbers of people running over our borders. In fact, we have very tough border controls at the moment. And folks who come up to the border and ask for asylum in the United States are jailed immediately. They're put in detention. In some cases, they might prove that they're not a threat to public safety and they might get released, but there's an extensive amount of vetting that's going on right now, and it actually horrifies me that the national political debate seems to focus on things that are just not true. People are not told the reality of the big apparatus that's in place right now to try to screen people. Most of the threats to the United States coming from the Middle East right now are actually from American citizens who've been radicalized over the internet. So they're people sitting in America right now. They're not trying to cross into America at all. They're here in America being radicalized over the internet. And the intelligence community has to deal with that. And the best way to deal with it is through information, to have robust intelligence capacity where you can identify folks that are getting radicalized and try to stop that from happening and stop the plots when they come up with them.
So you would not support the idea of stopping immigrants from coming into the country for a certain period of time or building a wall on the border with Mexico?
Well, I don't think people realize we already have extensive walls on the border. It's a myth that there's no wall down there.
Right.
I mean, there's no wall across the entire border, just
yes.
like there's no wall across the Alaska-Canadian border. But we have been building walls for decades now, and if you go down and check out the border, in certain areas of the border, you will see walls there, and you will see individuals heavily armed guarding the wall. You will see Border Patrol people driving up and down, and you will see all kinds of surveillance on the border happening right now.
Do you think that the wall needs to be bigger? Does it need to be expanded?
No. They need to make some improvements in certain areas where the walls are falling down, that sort of thing. I mean, the maintenance is pretty severe on what they've got down there. But the way to fix the immigration problem in America today is to fix the law. And this is one of the things few people realize. Our laws make absolutely no sense right now. You often hear people saying, we must enforce the law, we must enforce the law. But then when you tell them what the law is, they say, wait a minute, that's a crazy law. Is that really the law? I mean, I've had congressmen and senators call me and ask me to explain the law to them, and then they're shocked that when they find out what the law actually says. Our immigration laws are arbitrary, they're capricious, and they're irrational, and they're a big mess created by Congress over the years because Congress really doesn't understand the full text of the immigration laws. It's kind of like the tax code. You know, they really created kind of a mess over the years. You know, they'll pass one law here and one law there. And the best metaphor for this I got from Jeb Bush, who wrote a book called Immigration Wars. And the metaphor he gave for the immigration system was a leaky dam. He said that, you know, a dam is supposed to power the economy of a local community, provide hydropower to power the community, and the immigration system is supposed to provide power to the United States of America. People are a really wonderful resource, and if they're put to work and they're doing good things, they make our country stronger. But our immigration system has become this leaky patchwork of laws that don't make any sense, and one part's leaking, and another part the water's overflowing, and this part's been patched so many times that it just doesn't work. And the immigration system is no longer providing the power to our country that we need. Bush recommended in his book that we simply tear the wall out and build a new dam, an immigration system for the 21st century. That's what several senators proposed many years ago in their comprehensive immigration reform bill in the Senate. And we really need to do that. We need to update our laws, and then we need to enforce them. Because right now, we're just spending a tremendous amount of money enforcing a lot of laws that don't make any sense.
All right. Thank you for that answer. And we're going to go back to the phones and move on a little bit. Ron is in Fairbanks, and I think he has a question about the national debt. Hi, Ron.
Yeah. Hi, Margaret. I'll preface my question by saying that I hear Senator Murkowski talk at length about all the federal money she's bringing to Alaska. I never hear her have a plan for how am I going to deal with the national debt. So can you tell us your thoughts about the $18 trillion national debt and what we should do about it?
Well, I'm concerned about it, as most Americans are. And I know Alaskans like to have federal money flowing to Alaska, and that's understandable. The federal money should be coming for things that add to our economy, that will help us reduce the national debt, and it's possible to structure programs that can do that if they provide jobs and then people can pay taxes and so forth. One of the things I got very concerned about working at the Pentagon was that I saw a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. And it's almost mythic that there is such waste, fraud, and abuse at the Pentagon, but it's true. And I saw it happening. The Pentagon right now, by the way, can't be audited. That's how bad the books are. They have no way to audit them. I would like to see the Pentagon get audited in a way that, you know, every other business in America can expect. It makes no sense that we just have no control over the spending. I'd also like to see them cut the billions of dollars that we spend on wasteful projects. And there's a lot of waste going on right now in the Department of Defense and in the Department of Homeland Security. And we spend a lot of money on things because we did it in the past. And because we did something in the past, we don't question it for the future. An example of this is the nuclear triad. As you might know, there's three parts to the nuclear triad. There's the intercontinental ballistic missiles, and there's the sea-launched ballistic missiles, and then there's the bombers. And the triad hasn't been updated. You know, the equipment's out of date and everything. They're talking about updating it. But the generals in charge say that there's no reason to update the intercontinental ballistic missile system anymore. It's a waste of money, essentially. And yet people are moving ahead with plans to spend billions of dollars on what's an obsolete weapon system in the current modern strategic climate. I'd like to see programs like that cut back on. I would prefer not to spend money on things that we don't need to spend money on, particularly billions of dollars. And I'd like to bring more of a cost-benefit analysis to the equation. And that's what I intend to do as an independent. I won't be captive to these corporate special interests that push their particular programs. Another industry that I'm quite alarmed by is the private prison industry. I've seen minutes of corporate meetings where they talk about how the growth area no longer exists in American citizens committing crimes because there aren't enough Americans committing crimes for them to lock up, and so their profits are going to be lower. So they're now lobbying for tougher and tougher laws to allow more and more people to get locked up. And I think that's corrupt and wrong, and I would like to see an end to the use of private prisons to lock up people in America.
I'm going to have to ask you to hit pause for a moment. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with independent candidate Margaret Stock for U.S. Senate.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Salmon Life is an ongoing storytelling project celebrating the unique connections Alaskans have with their salmon. Explore the beautiful stories, meet the people, and help build a statewide community united by salmon love by visiting salmonlife.org. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our guest today is independent candidate Margaret Stock. She's running for U.S. Senate. We have a tremendous number of callers on the line. I just want to ask a question about seniority in Congress. Do you think that's important?
I don't think it's important if you're not going to use your seniority. And Senator Murkowski has not been getting things done. She talks a lot about her seniority but doesn't really use it to benefit Alaskans. I'm a much harder worker, and I think I can get things done without seniority that Senator Murkowski has not been able to accomplish.
Who will you vote for president?
Well, I'm not voting for Donald Trump. I don't believe he's fit to be president of the United States. I can't vote for somebody who calls on people to break the law, who says that he will jail his political opponents. He's going to use the power of the presidency, apparently, to retaliate against people. And so I'm not voting for Donald Trump. I plan to hold a press conference later this week and announce who I am voting for, but I didn't want to do it on Talk of the Nation today.
You're not stealing. We can't steal your thunder today?
Not today.
All right.
But it won't be Donald Trump for sure.
All right. We are going to go back to the phones with a question from Brian in Anchorage about the issue that I was hoping to get to next about the climate. Brian?
Hi. Just first off, I'm a combat vet, and I really appreciate your answers so far, and I appreciate your service. But also, I'm a forest entomologist, and I study basically the changing climate in South Central Alaska through beetles. And you wrote an op-ed a while back about your policy towards climate change, and I was wondering if you would care to elaborate on that today.
Sure, absolutely. I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that we need cheaper and long-term energy supplies that don't add to climate change. And it also doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that climate change is already hurting Alaska. I think we're seeing it all around us. You mentioned the beetles. I own a cabin out in McCarthy, Alaska, and I'm very familiar with the situation with the beetles. I'm also noticing things happening with the fish. And of course, I was up in Barrow a few weeks ago and noticed things happening with the ice. And you know, we're in the middle of a dramatic change. The most important thing is for us to realize it's happening and to listen to the scientists. And I do believe in science. I have a solid education. I, you know, went to school and studied a lot of scientific subjects. At one point in my life, I was a math and economics major, and I took a lot of science classes too. And I really do believe that climate change is happening. I'm not a climate denier. And we in Alaska are going to be dramatically impacted by this. And it's also an immigration issue, by the way. We're seeing the largest movement of people on the face of the planet right now ever in history, forced migration. A lot of times people say, well, it's due to wars, but it's also due to climate change, and we're going to see that in the future. So if we don't confront the issue right away and try to mitigate it, we're going to regret it, and our children and our grandchildren will also regret it.
Do you see, Margaret Stock, do you see climate change as a military national defense risk to the nation?
Well, it's both a risk and an opportunity in some ways, but the Pentagon recently announced that they are taking climate change into account in all their strategic planning, and I think that was a good announcement. I think it's overdue. I think those of us in the defense area have been looking at climate change for decades now and thinking that this is a big concern. And it's things like, you know, the Arctic opening up. We have to think about the national security implications of that. But it's also the movement of people who are forced out of their homes by climate change.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We have a lot of callers on the line. Michael is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Do you have a question?
Well, I have a comment and a thank you to the for running on this time in this climate with as much negativity. I really appreciate that you stepped up to run against an established candidate, and I do want to speak to her if I can.
Do you have a question, sir?
Well, it's more of a statement. I backed Senator McCain back in 2000. I've worked for President Obama and both his campaigns, and I supported Senator Murkowski in a write-in. So I'm an independent for sure, but her campaign literature and my contact with her has just been abysmal. She has done some incredibly odd behaviors at her rallies, and she's so again for this F-35, which to me is a wasted weapons platform. But I think that the being in the Air Force, having a background, I was Army myself, I've seen the waste and this wanton waste of the just keep shooting off the rounds and making money for America. It doesn't seem the way we want to hand this to our kids and our grandkids. And I really appreciate folks coming up, stepping up to the plate and running for office against this entrenched Republicans that we have up here. I'd love to see Alaska go Democrat.
All right. Thank you for the call, Michael. We are going to go now to Matt in Dillingham. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Margaret. I'll make it short. I'm a commercial fisherman, and as a group, we have little to no employer-based health insurance. Can you help us with this important issue?
Absolutely. I will help you with that. That's, I think, the biggest challenge facing the fishing industry right now is insurance. And I'm very much concerned about the ability of people to get insurance. I'm a small business owner. I have 10 employees in my business in Anchorage, and I've seen how the premiums have skyrocketed on the private exchange. Now we only have one provider providing insurance if you want to buy it on your own. And the premiums are crazy. I think if you're a fisherman, you might be looking at $24,000 a year to insure yourself and your family. You know, I'm guessing somewhere in there, but it might even be higher. And it's not right. I am in favor of having more people insured, so I don't want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but I do want to make the Affordable Care Act affordable. And there are a number of ways that we can do that. We can allow insurance to cross state lines. We can allow the government more negotiating power. We can try to make adjustments to the law to get a handle on the costs. The original law didn't deal much with costs, and that's really what's hurting Alaskans right now. We have the highest cost for insurance of any state, and our congressional delegation has done nothing to reduce that. And that's one key issue that I want to work on in Washington. I think it's terrible when people they get injured catastrophically and they have to declare bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court has become a way to get health insurance, you know, which makes absolutely no sense. we should all have access to affordable health insurance.
How would you do that? Would you advocate for a single payer system, or what would the changes be that you would want to see?
Well, one of the changes I'd like to see is Medicare for All, you know, to expand the coverage there. I'd like to see more crossing of state lines with insurance. And, you know, that's something that could be done. It's not impossible, and that would allow insurance companies to spread the risk throughout the whole country instead of looking at one small state like Alaska and saying, no, that's too risky. We don't want to write there. We could have, you know, the risk pool increased. And the trick with insurance is you got to get the healthy people to buy insurance so that when somebody gets hit by lightning, which is basically what happens when you get into a major car accident or you get cancer or something, that the risk is spread around amongst all of us. And we as a society, I think, understand that. We've had single-payer systems for the military, for the Veterans Administration, and for other communities. And so we need to think about creatively about how to get more people insured and to get the cost down.
All right. Thanks for that answer. Our guest today on Talk of Alaska is Margaret Stock. She is an independent candidate for U.S. Senate. She's joining us by the phone from KMXT in Kodiak. We're going to go back to the phones again. We're kind of topic hopping here, but that's all right. Eva is in Fairbanks. Hi, Eva.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
I do. Margaret Stock, this is the second time I've heard you speak, and I've been very impressed with your common sense, intelligent approach to solving the problems facing this country. And I like that you're not beholden to special interests, which leads to my question. What do you think should happen to overturn Citizens United decision and sort of level the playing field against the rich and powerful who have corrupted our political process?
Well, we probably need to do two things. One is we need more legislation in Congress. There was a bill called the Disclose Act, which would provide more transparency of contributions. Lisa Murkowski was the deciding vote that defeated the Disclose Act. It had passed the House, and it was about to pass the Senate, and she voted against it, so it failed. So I would support legislation for more disclosure of where contributions are coming from, such as the Disclose Act. And then I'd also like to overturn Citizens United, and that may take a constitutional amendment to undo the worst effects of that. But I would support an overturning of Citizens United.
All right. Thanks for the call, Eva. I wanted to get to some questions about rural Alaska. Yesterday, the first land into trust application was filed by the Craig Tribal Administration for a 1-acre parcel in Craig that has the tribal office building. As an attorney, what are your thoughts on Alaska tribes applying for trust status here in Alaska?
Well, I think it's a good idea. I support it.
All right. So do you have any kind of caveats that go along with that? I know the state wants to be able to review applications one at a time as they come in. They drop their suit against the idea of land in a trust, but they also want to review the applications, and then they'll just decide on a case-by-case basis whether they want to pursue litigation against them. Are there any that would give you concern?
Well, I'd have to look at the facts of the individual case. Obviously, sometimes people get concerned because they think land might not be put to an appropriate use, you know. But I think that's an issue for a case-by-case decision, and I wouldn't want to comment since I don't know of a particular factual situation.
What about law enforcement in rural Alaska? The state, as you're well aware, has serious budget issues. Trooper services certainly are not going to be added to in rural Alaska in this time of budget constraint. What needs to happen to help village communities have appropriate law enforcement? How can the federal government help?
Federal government can help a lot. And I mentioned earlier I was a military police officer in the Army Reserve for 28 years, and I've lived in Alaska for 30 years, so I'm familiar with law enforcement issues. And I also own a cabin in a remote part of Alaska where there are no law enforcement resources that are readily available. It'd probably take a trooper some 6 to 8 hours to get into where my cabin is if something happened. So I think the federal government plays a large role. The federal government has law enforcement resources of its own. The National Park Service, for example, does provide certain law enforcement resources in areas where there's a national park. But the larger issue for rural Alaska is how to get federal grant money in so that villages and tribes can take a role in law enforcement. And we're starting to see that. We're getting the rise in tribal courts. We could have more funding through the federal government for law enforcement in rural Alaska, particularly in areas where there are Native Alaskans have the ability to use those resources. So I think there is, you know, flow of federal law enforcement resources. It's already starting to happen. We're seeing some grant money coming in. It's an important way to supplement the state law enforcement in an era when the state is facing tremendous budget cuts.
Another issue that tribes and certainly people interested in healthy water and fisheries have been talking about transboundary mine issues in Southeast Alaska. And we have a question from a caller in Sitka. Matt has a question about transboundary rivers. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, hi. Actually, two kind of questions. One is, and this is something that affects commercial fishermen, sport fishermen, and subsistence fishermen, and we're all pretty much in the same boat. The International Salmon Treaty with Canada, which is now being renegotiated and being adversely affected for Southeast Alaska by the lower 48 and the transboundary rivers. I wonder if you could speak on the transboundary rivers and what you know about the salmon treaty down here in Southeast Alaska. I'll just listen into your answer, to what you know about it.
Thanks, Matt.
Well, I'm very much concerned about Alaska's renewable resources, and our fisheries are a key renewable resource. And, of course, the salmon are extremely important to the livelihoods of Alaskans. I know that I've done work, and I was a research fellow at the Border Policy Research Institute. We spent a lot of time working with the Canadians on cross-boundary issues. Most of my work related to national security, but I'm also very familiar with how the Canadian government deals with the U.S. government on a political level. And I think it's an important job of a United States senator to get involved in pressing our national government to negotiate properly on behalf of the states where the states are affected by a transboundary issue. I don't want to see more Mount Polys. I don't want to see our renewable resources harmed by mining in Canada that isn't properly taking into account the environmental needs of Alaskans and the need to preserve our fisheries. I would be a strong advocate for Alaskans on that issue, and I would take my knowledge of how the Canadian government works to pressure the right points in the U.S. government to make sure action actually happens rather than just words.
The Arctic is a growing concern and is drawing more and more international interest for resource extraction, control, search and rescue as sea ice retreats. You're retired military. What does our nation and our state need to be secure along the coast when more international vessels will be transiting it?
Well, we're going to need to put more resources into it. It's appalling to me that we are an Arctic nation and we have the least amount of resources put into the Arctic of any Arctic nation. The Canadians have a lot more resources. The Russians have a lot more resources. And we need to be putting, you know, more ice cutters. We need to be thinking about oil spill response. We need to be putting more Coast Guard up in the Arctic area. And we also need to be thinking about fishing. The last caller was talking about fishing. And, of course, we're going to have commercial fishing interests now heading up to the Arctic looking for fish. And we need to make sure that that resource isn't squandered. We want to keep it renewable as it develops. So there's a lot of work to be done in the Arctic. I think it's really critical. And I should mention to the listeners that there will be a debate up in Barrow in about 2 weeks on Arctic issues. And so I'd invite folks to check into that debate. I think so far Senator Murkowski and I are the only ones who have committed to the debate, but we will be having a full-scale debate on Arctic issues in Barrow shortly.
All right. Thanks for that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with U.S. Senate Independent Candidate Margaret Stock as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Margaret Stock is our guest today as we start the season of candidates on Talk of Alaska. We're going to go back to the phones quickly here. Danielle is in Juneau. Hi, Danielle. Hello? Well, maybe Danielle is no longer there. All right. We were talking about the Arctic before we went to a break, and you were talking about the needs there. The Obama administration has formally accused Russian hackers of trying to interfere with the U.S. election. It's a very serious charge. There's definitely been a cooling of the relationship with U.S. and Russia. What's your level of concern about Vladimir Putin's plan to have permanent military bases in Syria and this cooling off of our cooperative relationship with Russia and the U.S.?
I think it's troubling. We were making progress years ago on becoming more partners with the Russians on anti-terrorism issues and so forth, and we seem to have lost that sense of cooperation in the new modern climate. And, of course, the Russians are very interested in our presidential election. They're taking extreme interest in it, apparently, hoping to influence it in a way that's helpful to them. They obviously think somehow that Hillary Clinton's a threat to them, but they like Donald Trump a lot, so they seem to be trying to support Mr. Trump in his efforts to become president. And I find that troubling that the Russians would get so heavily involved in an election in the United States. It's a little bit unprecedented, and the cyber hacking is unprecedented. And, of course, our government hasn't always protected the records of Americans very well. We, at the Pentagon, were all victimized by a cyber attack where all of our records were stolen. And I'm very much concerned about that issue. I think cybersecurity is a really important component of our national security, and we need to be focusing a lot more resources on it. I worked on those issues when I was working on immigration and national security issues, and so I'm very concerned about them.
Do you think the American military is at the level it needs to be? Are changes in order? How would you characterize it currently?
Well, we need a lot more attention paid to cyber issues, and the national leadership is trying to do that. They're trying to get more folks on board who are able to deal with the modern issues that we face with attacks on infrastructure through cyber. You know, the cyber attacks concern people a great deal, and we're trying to put more resources into them, and I think we need to put more resources. And that's actually an area that Alaskans can be involved in. We have a university in Alaska that could be a center for the type of education people need in order to become cyber warriors. There's no reason why people in Alaska can't do that sort of thing. We have a lot of creative young people attending the University of Alaska, and I'd like to see more development of programs that address those pressing needs of our country up here in Alaska.
Well, we're going to continue topic jumping here because we're trying to cover a lot of ground and we only have a few minutes left. As you're well aware, Alaskans feel very strongly on both sides of the issue of abortion. Give us your viewpoint on abortion.
Well, I think as most Americans, I believe that we should try to reduce the level of abortions. And the best way to do that is through family planning and education. Women have a constitutional right to privacy, and they also have one in the Alaska Constitution, as well as one that the courts have developed through legislation. I would be considered pro-choice. I don't believe the government should be interfering with women's private health decisions. I think women are smart and educated and can figure out for themselves based on consulting with their families and consulting with their religious leaders, deciding what they should do with their bodies. That said, again, I think the best way to reduce abortions in America is through family planning and education. And I don't support defunding Planned Parenthood because I believe Planned Parenthood does more to reduce abortions than anything else with their family planning services and with their educational efforts.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go back to the phones just for one last quick question. Jared is in Anchorage. Jared, please get your question quickly.
Hi there. I was just wondering what was your plan for Alaska's economic future and what you would do to help improve our economy here in the state.
Thank you for that question, Jared.
Great question. I'd focus on getting jobs, and I'd focus on getting us off oil and gas as much as possible now that we've seen the price get lower, and try to get into alternative energy as a great source of jobs. I'd also like to see Alaska become a high-tech leader. It doesn't matter that we're far to the north. We can be a high-tech leader if we get better infrastructure to support high-tech industries. So I'd like to see more jobs in the energy sector, but I'd like to see them go from oil and gas into alternative energy. And it's going to take a while to transition that way, but we can do it. We should be the nation's laboratory for alternative energy, and we should have the most jobs and the highest paying jobs. Those could be highly skilled, high paying jobs if we just think a little more creatively about how to put our people to work doing that.
Let's flesh out the idea of economic development just for the last minute here. What kind of resource development, in your mind, is responsible and environmentally sound? What does that look like?
Well, it looks like the Alaska Sea Life Center, where they haven't, I was down there a couple weeks ago, and they told me they haven't burned any fuel oil in 3 years to heat their whole building. Why? Because they're using seawater. They're using high technology and a reversible heat pump to pump seawater into the building to heat the building. And those are the kinds of things we should be doing throughout Alaska. You know, use technology, be creative, and address the impacts of climate change, and also create jobs by creating technological jobs that will put Alaskans to work.
What would you say are the three biggest needs in Alaska right now?
Well, I'd say jobs, healthcare, and alternative energy.
All right. And you have said that you'd protect Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security from a Congress that, in your words, often makes irresponsible decisions. What do you mean by that? How would you protect these massive systems? We've got about 1 minute.
To give you one example, I wouldn't allow them to turn the systems into expensive private voucher systems that only prevent, that only cause private companies to benefit. I'd look for the people's interest and do what's right to give the people the services and the health care that they need at the least cost to the government and not to the benefit of special interests in big pharma and private industry.
Do you have ideas for how to stabilize and grow Alaska's economy so it's not dependent on oil and especially oil prices?
It's diversifying, and we should have, you know, people were predicting this many years ago that eventually the price would fall and that would be a problem for our economy. Other states saw the light. Texas decided to start diversifying because they realized this was going to happen. We did not. I think diversifying our economy is key, and that means looking at all of our renewable resources, not just looking at oil and gas, which, of course, is non-renewable, but looking at things like tourism, growing the high-tech industry, paying close attention to our fisheries. It's critical. That's a tremendously renewable resource if it's managed correctly.
All right.
So we need to diversify and we need to think for the future.
Thank you so much to Margaret Stock, independent candidate for U.S. Senate. Thanks to Ron Zastro and thanks to Wesley Early on phones and KMXT for providing the connection today. We'll be back next week with Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.